Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 23rd, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. Well, certainly it's been an interesting week, and we've had a number of tax developments this week going along with everything else that's happening in the world. And so we want to discuss this week some of what we have right now, as well as potentially talk about something that's in process. I'm recording this on Sunday morning, just after 6 a.m. Here in Mountain Standard Time, which is equivalent to Pacific Daylight Time. And as we stand right now, my understanding is we still have final negotiations going on in the Senate for what will be the major coronavirus bill. And that bill will have a number of tax provisions in it. Obviously, details matter, as I like to remind people. So we're not going to discuss what's in that bill at this point, because we don't really have it ready to go. We don't even have the text of the bill. So it's a little tough to say what's in the bill until we actually see the bill. But we will talk about some of the other stuff, because this week we had coronavirus bill number two. You're numbering these things now. Remember, number one was the first $8.3 billion basically appropriation to deal with the various items to gear up to fight the coronavirus. Number two, which we'll talk about today, is the bill that's involved primarily from our concern, is the paid sick leave and the tax credit. And then we also had two attempts at extending somehow the April 15th deadline. We'll talk about those two notices this week. We had a notice that came out early in the week that a few days later, basically at the very, actually the end of Friday, was superseded by a secondary notice. So we'll talk about where these things go. So what we have this week, let's talk about the first thing we're going to have. And the first thing we're going to have is the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which was H.R. 6201. We mentioned this one last week. It was passed and signed into law on March the 18th. The president signed it into law on that date. This particular bill had a number of things in it. We're going to concentrate, though, on two, because they're the things that have a tax impact, and this is a payroll tax impact, primarily. And no, it's not the payroll tax cut. I know some people had gotten confused about that. There'd been lots of discussion the prior week about doing some sort of payroll tax cut, getting rid of the FICA taxes for 6 months or some other deal. That idea appears to be, at this point, dead. There doesn't appear to be anybody talking about reviving that right now, although I'll probably be proven wrong later today. It'll be in the bill number three. But the last, which I had checked, we had nobody really pushing that. We moved on to other details. So the payroll tax computation bill, you got to keep up with this stuff because it moves very fast right now as to where we stand. And that's just keeping up on the tax side as to where we stand. So let's talk about this particular bill. This bill, interestingly enough, you have to realize this, it applies only to employers with 500 or fewer employees. The idea of this bill, and you got to understand the point of it, the point of this bill appears to be that many, many small employers, small medium-sized employers, that is 500 or fewer employees, generally did not offer paid sick leave. The concept of this bill was to effectively require them to offer 2 weeks of paid sick leave related to coronavirus issues, and there are six triggers that trigger this mandated leave. But, and then the theory was that the federal government would effectively pay for that, and we do that via a payroll tax credit or a refundable payroll tax credit. Now, we can talk about some of the problems mechanically with that in terms of, the cash flow issues that you have to pay the payroll today. And while you can reduce your deposit, if you have enough people on sick leave, and let's say you're a very small business, you have, two employees, and they both get exposed, very possible for everybody to get exposed in a small office, this could cause problems cash flow-wise. But we'll discuss that. We'll deal with it. It's still one of those issues we have to worry about. So let's talk about how this goes. First rule, and you have to understand the mandatory sick leave rule before you can possibly understand the credit, because the credit only covers people who have the mandatory sick leave. So here's the paid sick leave rules. There are six categories, and what it is, it's going to be the equivalent of 2 weeks' pay. We'll discuss how the 2 weeks work, but it's the equivalent of 2 weeks' pay, paid sick leave, for any employee if they are unable to work or telework, for any one of six conditions. Now, this is going to be somewhat important because the first three conditions get full or potentially full pay during the time the employee is off. The second three conditions get two-thirds of pay, or potentially two-thirds of pay, while the employee is off. So basically, there are three that are higher priority ones, and then there are three lower priority ones. There's also going to be, as we'll discuss here in a second, a special addition to the Family Medical Leave Act. And that's going to require you to give paid leave, if you have less than 500 employees, to employees under certain specific situations. But this situation is going to be very common, and we'll talk about how that works. So let's talk about, in this case, the issue of, and I'll get to full-time versus part-time here in just a second, but let's talk about first, you know, okay, I guess I should talk about the order I've got on my slides. I'll do it that way. If you're a full-time employee, okay, so you're there 80 hours a week, we essentially pay you for, you know, you're at least there 40 hours a week, we expect you to work 40 hours a week, then you get 80 hours of this special coronavirus leave. If you are a part-time employee, you don't usually work more than 40 hours a week, then we take your average hours over 2 weeks, how much on average do you work in 2 weeks, and we then use that as the amount of paid leave you're allowed to take. So those are your two key categories for this. We have that particular issue. Okay, we end up running it that way. There are the six triggers. Let's talk about those triggers. First, these are the first three big triggers. The employee is subject to federal, state, or local quarantine or isolation order related to COVID-19. If they are subject to a quarantine or isolation order related to COVID-19, they get 2 weeks of pay. If the employee has been advised by a healthcare professional to self-quarantine due to concerns related to COVID-19, that is the second category. And again, this is the 100% category. Third, the employee is experienced symptoms of COVID-19, and important second category here, is seeking a medical diagnosis. So you have an employee who comes down with some of the symptoms of COVID-19. They say, you know, they're staying home from work. They are seeking medical counsel to get a diagnosis. So while they're waiting that diagnosis, they are allowed to use part of this, part or all of this special 80 hours or special, let's say, 2 week paid leave, and I call it 2 week paid leave. We understand the hour rules are what I explain, but they get to use a special 100% 2 week paid leave, right? Now, the three categories that get the lower level of paid leave, and again, an employer can provide higher leave. There's no question about that, but this is the mandated. If an employee is caring for an individual who is subject to one of the orders, who is subject to quarantine, right, or has been advised to quarantine. So if you're caring for somebody, so you're having to stay home to care for somebody who's been quarantined or been advised to quarantine, even though you have not been quarantined or been advised to quarantine. So you might have to, let's say, you know, potentially your elderly grandmother is, you know, diagnosed, has a problem, is told to quarantine, has to stay home. And, you know, she lives, let's say, in a different town, like I'm here in Phoenix, she lives in Tucson. So I go ahead and I have to go to Tucson and take care of the elderly grandmother, right? That would qualify for this special secondary leave. If the employee is caring for a son or daughter of such employee, if the school or place of care of the son or daughter has been closed, or the child care provider of such son or daughter is unavailable due to COVID-19 precautions. This category exploded during the week, and there are a lot of employees now who would fit in this category for the reduced paid leave. Now, again, it's 2 weeks only. And, you know, we'll talk about it, but this one's going to get a little better than 2 weeks. We'll talk about how this one grows a bit more. And the last category is the employee has experienced any other substantially similar conditions specified by Health and Human Services in consultation with the Secretary of Treasury and Secretary of Labor. So category six is other things that the agencies administratively can add to the list. Okay, so we don't have at this moment, as far as I know, no guidance has been issued on this one. So there's no category six people at this point. So we have, for the moment, five triggers, if you're subject to those five triggers, right? The amount you'll be paid, as I mentioned here, if you're in the first three categories, right, you compute your pay, and the first computation is your standard rate of pay, right? If the standard rate of pay is below the minimum wage, you have to pay minimum wage. That's going to affect restaurants, right? Because they get tips. They get to account tips toward the minimum wage. Obviously, those tips will not be paid, so they have to count that tip amount. They've got to up the salary to minimum wage now instead of being able to backfill with tips. So during the paid leave, they would have to do that. And the maximum amount per day for this 2 weeks of paid leave is $511 per day. So 100% salary, $511 per day. As we recall, that roughly works out that you max this out. If you have an annual salary of about $133,000, you're going to max out the limit. If you're below that limit, you will get 100% of your pay. If you're in the final three categories, that pay gets a lower amount. That's the one that gets two-thirds of what they'd get for the 100% leave, so two-thirds of pay generally. But this one is capped at 200, and you'll note 200 is not two-thirds of 511. This is a lower cap. So for a lot of people, this one I think caps out somewhere in around 70,000 or so. I forget the number right now. But it caps out for a much lower salary level. So a lot more people will be at the $200 per week amount for this sick leave if they use this one, right? So this one is open for that. That's the amount that you can use in your paid sick leave. Now, let me talk about some other things here before we go on to the FMLA leave. The employer cannot require as a condition of providing this leave that the employee find a replacement employee to cover the hours, right? I have to provide this to an employee regardless if they had just started the day before. If they started yesterday and they're coming to become one of these categories today, then you have to give them this leave, right? Now, the employee may first use this paid special leave before any other leave from the employer. So the employee can say, I know I have the right to use 2 weeks of vacation. I could use that instead of my sick leave, but I have a right to push this to the front. Let's say I have 2 weeks of regular sick leave under the employer's plan. I can push this special paid sick leave in front of that regular 2 weeks of paid sick leave. So they have a right to push this to the front. That's required. And as you would expect, employers are barred from retaliating against employees for making use of this provision or for taking action against them. Now, this one will probably get some employers in trouble because I'm sure it will occur to some employers why don't we just lay everybody off who might be covered? Oh, this person, I know they have a kid in school, and so maybe I'll just lay them off ahead of time because we know they're going to, they might have to do this. That would be a problem, shall we say. I suspect under this rule, I'd be a little this. Now, right, we do this. Now, if you do this, you get to claim a credit. It's a credit against FICA taxes paid and withheld on the 941. Okay, so if you, let's say, had a total liability on the 941 for FICA taxes of $10,000 and you paid out $5,000 of sick leave under these provisions that meet one of these six categories, you would be able to reduce your FICA paid in by $5,000. The theory of that, at least is how Congress thinks of it, is that, that means you'll reduce your payroll tax deposit since that deposit was required anyway. You're not cash out of pocket. But the problem is a little different. What if you have $5,000 of FICA, but you just incurred $10,000 of paid sick leave? Well, then it's like, now we got a little problem because even if we don't make the withholding payment, we still got an issue. They are going to make that refundable. But apparently the refundable, and by the way, the IRS announced and Treasury announced that guidance on this will come out in this week. So keep your eyes on it. We've not got that at the very end of the week. So guidance comes out this week on this issue. But you would get your refund from the Form 941. Now, there is another special category of paid leave under here you have to be aware of. This is the special FMLA paid leave. This only covers a single case. If you remember the fifth case we had of the regular paid leave. In this case, you can use up to 10 weeks is used for this, right? If a taxpayer is unable to work or telework due to a need for leave to care for the son or daughter under age 18, if the school or place of care has been closed, or the child care provider of such son or daughters is unavailable due to a public health emergency is a COVID-19 situation. This applies. Now, it is FMLA, so you may think, I don't have 50 employees, I'm good. No. For this one, the definition is not that you have 50 or more employees on a regular basis at the site. This definition is you have less than 500 employees. The 50 employee definition disappears. This applies to everybody the first one applies to. Okay. Now, again, the limit here is 10 weeks, right, of this pay. Now, they have to take 2 weeks first, kind of a waiting period, can be unpaid. But here's your problem. If that 2 weeks can be unpaid, but the employee has the right to use up any paid leave option they might have in lieu of making that unpaid. So essentially, the employer could elect to make it unpaid. You know, the employee can say, okay, no, I don't want it to be unpaid for 2 weeks while I'm taking care of my child. I want to use up my 2 weeks of Category 5 regular sick pay and be paid for those 2 weeks. And that will count as my 2 weeks of unpaid under this FMLA rule. And then I get 10 weeks of, it would appear, the regular old paid FMLA now for those 10 weeks for taking care of the child. Now, that's, you know, you might ask yourself, well, then why didn't they just make it, you know, 12 weeks for this and just ignore it? I think most people have come to the conclusion that this was put in this way just in case the parent, let's say, was diagnosed with COVID-19 and or had to quarantine due to COVID-19. And because of that, you know, then they could still use their 2 weeks of full paid, not the 60%, and then swap over to this to take care of the child. Okay, that's, you know, one of those issues that we may have, or the child had it, whatever. We can use the 2 weeks at full pay, and then we can use this at a lower pay to trigger this in. So the concept there, it does apply to the same credits. Okay, the maximum pay on this, again, is $200 per day. It's the two-thirds test. Maximum payout is $10,000 over the term. So for the employee, so that's the amount we would get hit with. Now, you know, you have to, oh, by the way, for both of these, you must give prominent notice to employees of their rights involved with this. The Department of Labor is supposed to get that notice out. And, you know, we're supposed to be kind of, you know, making sure that we have notice in both cases and it's in the prominent place and all of those standard routines. The payroll tax credit is available for both, for not only just for people who are employees, but self-employed also get a right to claim this credit. That's also kind of interesting. So self-employed individuals can still get the refundable payroll tax. Obviously, what the idea there is, which works in this way, the self-employed person would not have to make their estimated tax payment. And at the end of the year, if it turns out because they've had an awful year, and I expect a lot of self-employed individuals will have an awful year, we could still make it refundable to them for the sick pay portion. Now, that sounds okay, except, you know, when you think about it, they're actually going to get that refundable sick pay next April, you know, which presumably is well after they've had this event. You know, it would be, right? I mean, if you're going to trigger for sick pay, they had to have had the event this year. But if they really don't end up, turns out they just have no self-employment tax liability whatsoever for the year, yeah, they're going to finally get the money back for this next year. So, yeah, for self-employed, it's there. It'll be interesting. We'll see how everything runs. General rules, you know, you cannot ask employees for a diagnosis on paper. You know, that's why you can't force them to basically do it, I guess, is the way it works, because they're concerned with overwhelming the medical system. Oh, and by the way, it also does not apply to healthcare professionals. Right. If your business is in the business of providing health care, let's say, or not your business, say you have an employee who is providing health care, that's an excludable employee. Right. A healthcare provider or emergency responder is excluded. Obvious reason. I mean, yeah, the reality is they don't want them disappearing for 2 weeks right now. You know. We'll talk about, you know, you can talk about that all you want. It's a policy decision, so that's where we're going. But emergency responders and healthcare professionals are not required to be covered under this rule. Well, then we got into this whole issue about the April 15th deadline. And the Treasury Secretary had mentioned an issue that we were going to try to push this back and put $200 billion into the economy. And the IRS's first try at this came out on the 18th of March, the same day as 6201 was signed into law. And this was the pushback. The Treasury Secretary had said when the president declared, you know, essentially the disaster, the Treasury Secretary had come out and told us that he was going to delay. There'd be no need for people to pay their taxes on April 15th. Well, and that's fine. There'd be an automatic deferral. It wouldn't be for the super rich. Okay. Now, he never said, and in fact, he emphasized heavily, you know, if you got a refund, you want to file right now, get it filed by April 15th. That was like the first thing he said. The second thing he said is you wouldn't have to pay. Now, some people thought, oh, he's, you know, he never said that we're going to get an extension of time. He just doesn't understand, you know, how taxes work. He's so out of touch. It was that was intentional wording. We got notice 2020-17 made it very clear. And there was an automatic payment, so a payment could be deferred up to $1 million. If you owed up to $1 million on April 15th, you could defer that until July 15th. But there would be no extension. So the payment was Form 1040 and the first quarter estimate. Those were the two items covered by it, right? When Treasury Secretary announced this issue, there was a lot of confusion. We saw news stories, and more than stories, headlines were the problem. That told us that, you know, all tax filing deadlines were pushed back 3 months. It wasn't quite the case, right? We had that problem. Now, once it became clear, with this notice came out, that there was no extension of time to file and that 4868s would still have to be filed, CPAs and accounting organizations protested loudly. And so lots of things happened. Eventually, what happened was, on Friday morning, we got this from the Treasury Secretary. For those of you looking at the slides, we have Steve Mnuchin's tweet. His tweet says, quote, at Real Donald Trump's, if you haven't been on Twitter, that's the handle for the president, direction, we are moving tax day from April 15th to July 15th. All taxpayers and businesses will have this additional time to file and make payments without interest or penalties. Okay, that's Friday morning. This is what we have via Twitter. We know we're going to get a filing extension, but we don't have details. On Friday night, right, late Friday night, released on Friday, early evening Eastern time, just about a little over 2 days after we had released the first notice that everybody got upset about because there wouldn't be an extension, we got this brand new notice, 2020-18. 2020-18 extends income tax, individual income tax, I shouldn't say individual tax, let's be very careful. It extends tax returns for all individuals and all persons is the term that's used. That means it does include corporations, estates, trusts, and the like. Why do we know that? Because persons are defined under Section 7701A1 of the code, and persons, we are told, when it's used, means all of those. So it does say persons, and in fact, the notice actually comes out and says that's exactly what it means. We do cover all these people, right? Now, one catch is it does say it is available, and this is a quote from the section, the relief provided in Section 3 is available solely with respect to federal income tax payments, including payments of self-employment income, due on April 15th. Okay, and then they're going to talk about in respect of an affected taxpayer's 2019 tax year and federal estimated tax payments, including payments of self-employment tax, due on April 15th for an affected taxpayer's 2020 year. Okay, that's what it covers. Now, let's piece a couple things together because people get freaked out about various things here, right? Okay, here's the catch. The first thing we're going to get freaked out about is we're going to say affected taxpayer. It's like, well, does that mean I got to prove I have coronavirus? Or, you know, if I don't have coronavirus or my employee does have coronavirus, we're sunk. Or, you know, the taxpayer doesn't. No. The law defines very, very carefully. In essence, affected taxpayer is a term in Section 7508 Cap A. That term in 7508 Cap A is who the relief applies to that the Treasury Secretary can delay filing dates for. So that's why it is a taxpayer affected by the disaster. That's why affected taxpayer has to be defined because those are the only parties that can get relief. But what the IRS has done always in disasters is broadly define affected taxpayers, and that's exactly what they've done here. The Secretary has determined, this is quote from the notice, the Secretary has determined any person with a federal income tax payment due April 15, 2020 is affected by the COVID-19 emergency for purposes of the relief described in Section 3. That is an affected taxpayer. So, gang, if you have a return due, an income tax return due on April the 15th, you have an estimated tax payment due on April the 15th for 2020 tax year, you are an affected taxpayer. As an affected taxpayer, you're covered by this ruling. You do not have to prove anybody had COVID-19. You do not have to prove that your kid had it or that there's nothing. That's not required. Everybody gets this particular piece of relief. So don't get worked up by that. Now, the other problem is, what exactly does it cover? And it is very narrowly written to say it covers April 15th, so your tax return due, income tax return due on April the 15th, right? So an income tax return due on April the, you know, let's say May the 15th or March the 15th is not covered by this, right? Only April 15th. So that means basically calendar year trusts, right? Calendar year trusts, estates, calendar year, you know, trust estates, let me get my right things in here, corporations, C corporations, etc., they would all be taxpayers covered by this. In theory, if one somehow had a calendar year S corporation, you know, that had an income tax return due on that date, but they said it's not covered for base returns, but let's say you owed built-in gains tax, apparently that might be covered, but I doubt we have many of those that are going to be in play. Right, so it's going to just be that limited set of taxpayers, right, that are involved. It's got to be an April 15th deadline, and it has to be an estimate due on April 15th that is for the 2020 tax year. It also tells that very clearly, okay? Those are all that's covered. Now, that does mean it appears we still have a quirk that this does not appear yet to cover the second estimated tax payment on June 15th, which comes before July 15th. Okay, I don't know if Treasury plans to wait and see if everything's calmed down by then, or if Treasury is going to just do that later, but for whatever reason, and that problem was pointed out when the first notice came out that the second one wasn't covered, we don't know if we're going to get any additional relief there or not. We've also seen a number of people suggest, well, why don't we just pay double on the first one, and we don't have to pay that till July, and that would work. I'm not sure the law works that way, and I certainly wouldn't want to say that that's going to go. Again, no relief on number two. I think number two is going to look at, if I follow the law the way I'm reading it at the moment, it's going to look at literally what was paid on June 15th, and if that first estimate wasn't paid, you're not allowed to get credit for the fact you overpaid that estimate. Now, it also raises an interesting question. What if a client's overpaid on the 1040? You know, that gets kind of interesting, or they throw extra on the extension. Yeah, that's all getting messy. I would be, you know, I'm going to tell clients, if we don't get clarification by June 15th, we better make the June 15th estimate payment, right? We'll work with that, okay? Now, there also is no limit on the amount deferred. The $1 million rule is gone. So don't worry about the $1 million rule. That's not actually going to be a problem. We totally supersede Notice 20-2017. So anything you read before Friday, or even that was published Friday morning, about how this was going to work, forget it, right? Come back now, and we're going to go into this new notice. You should not be checking 2020-17. You want to check Notice 2020-18, the next notice coming up. That's going to be the key to make this happen. That's how this goes. Now, I should say, also gotten questions from people. Again, only April 15th income tax returns, so no, not for profits. We have nothing yet on the May 15th extension. Again, this is a developing issue. I suspect that as, you know, we keep moving forward, if we keep having problems through that date, that we'll probably get an extension of that one automatically too. But, you know, for the moment, keep working on those as if you're going to have to make those extensions. You have to make those, file those on time, or put the extension in at May 15th. Similarly, no mention yet of payroll tax reports due at the end of April. Again, they're not going that far. This is a limited guidance only. Stay tuned. We expect to hear more, but we don't have it right now, right? So do that. It applies to both income tax and self-employment tax, right? For that, we mentioned that already. And does not apply to any other type of tax or return. That's also made clear in the notice that it's limited relief, right? The limited relief is going to be for no tax, for tax returns, right? You know, and we have all of these issues, right, that we go on for this. No extensions provided this notice for the payment or deposit of any other type of federal tax or for the filing of any federal tax information returns, okay? So basically, you know, we have a little quirk. Now, the second estimate, if you can quirkily read parts of this notice, I think it's in as well. So that we're going to hope for clarification. We also don't know. You know, what the IRS tells us in here is we don't have to file a 4868. And then they say, you know, taxpayers who need more time, you know, will be able to, you know, can file a 4868. But they don't say openly that you can do that in July. And so there is still some concern. I'm 98% sure that's what they mean. But there's that 2% that bothers me that maybe it's not totally clear that you can, you know. So the question is, do I have to file 4868 in April to make sure I have until October to do this, or should I, you know, do I wait until, can I wait until July 15th, have a much better idea of the tax due, and then file that extension? Again, we don't know. All of these things we would expect to be clarified by the IRS, we would hope, somewhere over the next week or two, and to help us with this. So the big takeaway at this point, expect to see more IRS guidance this week. Pay careful attention to what the IRS puts out in notices. Pay careful attention to that guidance from the Department of Labor and the IRS for the sick pay. I mean, and watch for that bill that is moving through Congress. If that becomes law, there are a number of tax provisions there. Now, the catch is a lot of those tax provisions are not necessarily going to be things that have a direct impact on the current year. At least the last set I looked at would not have direct impact now, but they are going to be things you probably have to be aware of because clients will ask you about issues like taking money from their retirement account, their IRA account, at this point, having the three-year repayment potential rule. And how does that work? And you got to explain some things to them about what's waived, what's not, and how it works. And we're going to have to find out a lot more. So that's it. So here we go. Whoops. The questions, as I said, what about other items tied to April 15th? IRA contributions. We don't know yet if IRA contributions move back. You know, it depends on how you read the section 219F5, how you read that and how you read what's been done. The 965 installment payments, remember those? That's due on April, on the unextended due date of the original return. What is the unextended due date of the original return? Is this an income tax payment? So are we okay paying this in July, or is this one that has to be done in April? Again, we don't know about that. And we talk about the Form 4868 at July 15th. Do we have to do those to get to October 15th? You know, do we do them in July to get to October 15th, or are we going to have to do those in basically in April? I think a lot of us would probably consider that, wait, I don't know what's happening from here on out. So if I can't wait till July to file a 4868 for an extension, then I got to get all these extensions still done at April 15th. So we'll have to see how that works. What about other taxes? The net investment income tax, right? The household employee payroll tax. Are they covered by this? Probably, but again, we're going to hope for IRS clarification on these issues in the coming week. So keep it going. Now, it's been one of those weeks, as one person on Twitter was specifying, talked about being about 50% productive this week in terms of everything, the stresses and non-tax stresses that people are being under. Obviously, at this point, things are happening. But also, it was kind of interesting, and one person said, yeah, unless you consider being, you know, slavishly following tax developments, you know, minute by minute to be productive, then we were very productive this week because we were all trying to do that. So keep your eye on the developments. We'll let you know. You know, we'll be back here next week because regardless of shelter at home or whatever, I'm recording this at home now. So bottom line, it looks like we'll be able to keep this going without any issues. No problems there. I can still do this product because I'm not at the office. I don't have to do it there. So we'll keep that going. Now again, CP for due 20, our sign says start planning. Okay, it's a little bit early to plan probably at this point. We've got some changes coming. Probably some things happening, some things get redone. But do consider, continuing education is going to be important, and we are going to have information regarding this. Now, I know a number of state societies has offered various programs, some of them, you know, one-hour for pay programs, some of them, you know, free programs on issues that have been rising related to this. You know, you can keep an eye out for that, what your state society is doing. I know most seem to be responding in some way, shape, or form. I know I'm going to be doing an hour for free for Arizona. For the Arizona Society members to come in. We'll talk about what's happened by Wednesday, which of course is, that's why these courses are kind of open. I've seen a couple of them and we're all open. It's whatever's happened by the time we do the course, we'll try to talk about. Because it's really tough. Usually you try to write a course and, you know, tell people, oh, you know, we're going to talk about this, 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 and this. You know, notice 2017 was a big deal for 2 days and that's totally irrelevant, right? You know, the sick leave was a big deal, but if you're under full lockdown, then we're looking at a slightly different set of rules, right? We're looking at different things. Oh, I should mention, too, on the paid sick leave, it does not supersede or take away any rights an employee may have under state law, collective bargaining agreement, or an employer's own policy. So basically, if your state law is 13 due mandate sick leave, then you're going to have to comply with that along with the federal law. You know, you can't just, you know, you can't say, oh, skip it. You know, the feds wouldn't require me to pay for this, but Arizona does. But hey, you know what? The feds take over. Arizona doesn't matter. No, Arizona would still matter. So you'd have to take a look at both sets of laws. Okay. Well, this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments. You can catch updates during the week as things happen and I get time to write things because I have, you know, like all of us right now, I've got a whole bunch of things happening going on in the world. So we got lots of things happening with the practice and getting ready and, you know, dealing with people and dealing with the whole idea of working from home and all those other issues that are going to be involved and getting all that stuff done. But I will try to post updates as I get a chance if something happens. Certainly follow me on Twitter because there I can just post as soon as the IRS officially releases something, I can post there. To follow me on Twitter, it's at Ed Zollars, and you can follow me there. I'll post what happens. I'll post anything I get. You know, as soon as I get a notice, I try to post things up there. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollars@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I also follow discussions on the subreddit of /r/taxpros. I've also been following, and now this becomes important because especially with these shelter-in-place orders that are cropping up in different states, local state society discussion forums are really important. I follow discussions in Arizona, Minnesota, New Jersey, also follow the Cal postings. Among those four states, California and New Jersey are both effectively in a lockdown, so there's been discussions about how those impact CPA firms. Hint, it's going to be state-specific, so you got to check the state rules and see what's considered an essential service, see what you're supposed to do, see if you have to close your office. Normally, it appears what's going to be happening here is CPAs have become quasi-essential because, I guess, payroll needs to be paid. But payroll needs to be paid and sales tax reports need to be filed, etc. But they are strongly suggesting that only the people who have to be at the office be there and as many as possible work from home. So if you've not thought out, if you're not yet in an area that's impacted directly by this, you don't yet have a, you know, a formal lockdown notice, you should by now for your business be planning, how would we handle that issue? How could we handle if everybody, if, you know, if most people are not allowed to come in the office, if the clients are not allowed to come in our office, how are we going to handle dealing with the clients? How are we going to handle the other issues? And, you know, how are we going to handle getting people working from home, you know, to make this work? I know it's stressful for a lot of people, but take a deep breath. You know, tax practice is one of the overall, of all the things you can be forced to do from home, this is one of the, I'm not saying it's easy, but easier ones to make work. Certainly, it's a lot simpler to do this than to run a warehouse from home, right? You know, somebody needs to be there to move stuff. So we do have the option. If you've not done the planning, please take a look at that. With that, we will be back next week. Current Federal Tax Developments, we'll be back here on the 30th. May have the brand new tax law to work with. Probably will have other things that have happened because this has been a rapidly changing situation. So, you know, what we had a week ago is very different than what we have now. And I expect what we're going to have a week from now will be very different from what we have today. So take care, be safe, and we'll see you back here next week.